This is a Battle of Britain podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.
September 15th, 1940. As dawn broke on Sunday the 15th of September, there was nothing to distinguish it from previous days experienced during the summer of 1940. The threat of invasion hung over the country, and yet the general population continued to get on with their lives as best they could. By the end of the day, the Royal Air Force would be left with a sense of having had a good day, whilst the Luftwaffe's morale would be broken, and the 15th of September 1940 would consequently come to be seen as being a decisive point in the Battle of Britain, itself a turning point in the war. So where does the 15th lie in the history of the battle? Traditionally, the battle is considered by the RAF as running from the 10th of July to the 31st of October, and the 15th falls into what is known as the third phase. During the 1st, 10th of July to the 7th of August, the Luftwaffe focused their attacks on convoys in the Channel, radio direction finding stations and coastal towns, probing and testing the country's defences. In the second phase, 8th of August to the 6th of September, they assaulted the British defences, especially RAF stations, radar sites and aircraft factories. The aim was to destroy the aircraft of Fighter Command and its capability to carry on the fight. As a result, August was a particularly hard month for Fighter Command, and for No. 11 Group especially. From the 13th of August, known to the Germans as Eigletag or Eagle Day, heavy raids by the Luftwaffe focused on destroying the RAF in the southeast. The air defence of Great Britain operated on a geographical basis, and No. 11 Group was responsible for the southeast of England and London. Bearing the brunt of these attacks, many of the RAF stations in this area were badly damaged, and only remained operational through the heroic efforts of the ground staff. These personnel often remained at their posts during heavy attacks. Three WAFs, Elspeth Henderson, Helen Turner and Elizabeth Mortimer, were awarded the Military Medal for their courage and example of a high order and in showing amazing pluck during the intensive bombing of Biggin Hill. Without the dedication and bravery of all of the ground staff in trying to keep the stations operational and the aircraft serviceable, there is no doubt the battle would have been lost. As it was, equipment and valuable aircraft were destroyed, and the men and women of No. 11 Group began to reach breaking point. However, relief came in early September from an unlikely source. A shift in German tactics took place. Their focus shifted from knocking out the RAF on the ground to attacking the major cities, especially London. In late August, German bombs had accidentally dropped on London during a night raid. Bomber Command launched several raids against Berlin in retaliation, and, enraged, Hitler took the decision to focus his Luftwaffe attacks on London. The aim was to destroy civilian morale and force a surrender, but the head of the Luftwaffe, Hermann Göring, also believed that the RAF was down to its last few hundred aeroplanes. He believed that a massive blow against London, or rather a series of blows, for the 15th of September would be the only day to witness two mass daylight bombing raids targeted on the capital, would draw up the tattered remains of Fighter Command to be destroyed by the Luftwaffe. The anticipated result was that Germany would gain air superiority over southern England, enabling Operation Sea Lion, the invasion of Great Britain, to take place. The week preceding the 15th of September, therefore, saw bombs falling on London and other major towns and cities during the day. This shift in focus, combined with a couple of days' bad weather, effectively gave Fighter Command the breathing space it needed to recoup its equipment losses and to repair the airfields. It provided RAF personnel day-long rest periods and the opportunity for training sorties. The sudden and very welcome respite from incessant attack had a huge psychological impact on pilots and ground staff alike. The 15th of September therefore began with Fighter Command in better shape than the German High Command realised. The fact that the raids on London had been met with little resistance appeared to support the German belief that Fighter Command was at a low ebb. The morning of the 15th of September started quietly for the RAF, with routine patrols being undertaken by Coastal and Fighter Command, and enemy patrols being observed and plotted too. At around 10:30 a.m, the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, arrived at No. 11 Group Headquarters at RAF Uxbridge on one of his regular visits. Air Chief Marshal Sir Keith Park, officer commanding No. 11 Group, would have been anticipating enemy action, as the weather reports indicated it would be a fine, clear day. And yet he commented to the Prime Minister that,
"I don't know if anything will happen today. For the moment, everything is quiet."
Certainly, Vera Shaw, a WAF on duty in the plotting room since 7 a.m, had had a quiet shift and was keeping herself occupied by reading and writing letters. At about the same time, reports from the radio direction finding, or chain home stations along the coast, began filtering through, informing Fighter Command Headquarters, based at RAF Bentley Priory, that enemy aircraft had been tracked, forming up over northern France. Shortly before 11 a.m, these aircraft turned towards the coast in a formation some 2 miles wide. This first major attack of the day consisted of around 100 Dornier bombers with upwards of 200 fighters as escort. Immediately, Fighter Command scrambled to meet them. Over the next 15 minutes, between 11:05 and 11:20, aircraft from 11 squadrons of No. 11 Group were ordered up, closely followed by one squadron of 10 Group and five from No. 12 Group. Park skillfully manoeuvred his squadrons into place. The Germans crossed the coast near Dungeness just before 11:30 a.m. And 10 minutes later, as the first Spitfires swept in on them over Maidstone, another six squadrons were also ordered to scramble. Squadron leader Richard Barclay, flying with 249 Squadron, based at RAF North Weald, noted in his diary that,
"We scrambled at about 11:30, climbing up above 8/10 cloud over London."
He recalls grabbing a pair of Irving trousers before getting in his plane and was therefore able to fly with the cockpit canopy of his Hurricane open. He noted that,
"One can see much better flying that way."
As the enemy formation sped towards London, a running fight developed. The RAF squadrons, singly or in pairs, were directed by Park via his sector controllers to hit the enemy formation in succession. The German fighter escorts reacted by turning to face the attacks and were soon embroiled in chaotic dogfights across the skies over Kent. The question of the relative merits of the different British and German fighters has been hotly debated, but often the outcome of such fights came down to the individual skill, tactics and experience of the pilots. Squadron leader Eric Seaborn describes an essential of air-to-air combat.
"You don't fly more than a few moments looking straight ahead. You were always twisting your neck, looking behind you. If the sun was behind you, that was the most dangerous time."
The fighting was also visible to those on the ground. In a letter held in the museum's archive, a schoolboy recounts to his mother seeing a fighter in the sky.
"We heard guns, machine guns, and the air was full of sound. We thought we might see the fun, so we went to where we could see the sky. We saw little white specks moving about, and suddenly my friend said, 'Look up there,' and we did. We saw a plane coming down. I'll never forget it. It caught the sun with a trail of smoke coming from it, twisting and turning."
As these dogfights drew away the escorts, the bombers became increasingly vulnerable. By the time they reached London, shortly after midday, the bombers were under heavy attack and taking serious losses. Waiting for them over London were a further six squadrons of No. 11 group. Shortly after this, a further five squadrons from No. 12 group, the Duxford Big Wing, led by squadron leader Douglas Bader, joined them. Czechoslovaks of No. 302 squadron and the Poles of No. 310 squadron formed part of this wing, made up of two squadrons of Spitfires and three of Hurricanes. The tactic of squadrons attacking in formation as big wings has been much debated since the war, but on the 15th of September it proved highly effective, smashing through and scattering the German formations. German gunner Hans Sonderland described the experience vividly.
From the time we had been over Maidstone until reaching the outskirts of London, we had been under extreme pressure. The British fighters had been with us since we had first crossed the English coast and had gathered in intensity all the time. We saw the Hurricanes coming towards us, and it seemed the whole of the RAF was there. We had never seen so many British fighters coming at us at once. We saw what must have been 100 RAF fighters. Where were they coming from? We'd been told that the RAF fighters were very close to extinction. We could not keep our present course. We turned to starboard, doing all that we could to avoid the fighters, just dropped our bombs and made our retreat.
Although the main Luftwaffe formations succeeded in reaching central London and in dropping their bombs, the bomb damage was scattered across central and south London. This first running battle is officially recorded as lasting between 11:30 a.m. and 12:45 p.m., by which time the last German aircraft had limped back across the channel and the RAF fighters returned home. Back on the ground, Squadron Leader Barclay recorded in his diary that
"We had a rotten lunch in our dispersal hut, sitting on our beds."
Pilots were debriefed by intelligence officers generating combat reports. Sergeant William Rolls, serving with 72 Squadron, relayed his experience over Brenchley.
"I took off from Croydon as Green 1 in the second section, climbed to 24,000 feet. I saw an ME-109 coming down, passed well over my head. I climbed up after it, and at about 200 yards I gave a burst of about 2 or 3 seconds underneath it. I saw a big black patch appear and several small ones on the fuselage. I saw tracers coming from behind me as well as in my mirror. I saw another ME-109 coming down on me. I evaded it. I did not see what happened to the other, except that it was in a dive as I was in a steep turn."
Shortly after 1:45, reports of a second major attack began filtering through. By 2 o'clock, it was clear that this attack was even larger than the first. 150 bombers were protected by a mass of 400 fighters. The whole formation split into three waves, covering a front of 10 miles. Again, 12 squadrons of No. 11 group were scrambled and were airborne before the enemy aircraft crossed the coast near Dover between 2:14 and 2:20. Squadron leader Barclay recalls,
"We were scrambled again at 2 o'clock, joining 46 Squadron beneath the cloud layer."
A further nine squadrons of No. 11 group and five from 12 group were airborne by 2:15. Goering had planned the second wave on the assumption that whatever few fighters the British had left, they would still be unable to refuel and rearm in time to meet it. Instead, the tremendous efforts of the ground crews saw fighters streaming back into the sky. Flight Lieutenant Peter Brothers, serving with 32 Squadron, highlighted the debt owed to the ground crews when he commented that
"We wouldn't have got off the ground but for them. They were all super."
Again, Air Chief Marshal Park directed his squadron skillfully, orchestrating a constant stream of attacks against the German formations. For about an hour during the afternoon, all of No. 11 Group squadrons were committed. Watching the tote board in the operations room at RAF Uxbridge, the Prime Minister Winston Churchill would later recall in his memoirs that presently the red bulbs showed the majority of the squadrons were engaged. A subdued hum arose from the floor where the busy plotters pushed discs, in accordance with the swiftly changing situation. WAF Hazel Gregory was working as a plotter in the operations room at RAF Uxbridge. She recalls that,
"On the 15th of September, I was plotting a raid of 400-plus aircraft.
The size of the raid meant that
you couldn't see the surface of the table, it was so covered with movements.
After running the gauntlet across Kent, the Luftwaffe was met by a further host of British fighters. 10 squadrons from No. 11 Group were waiting, while the 5 squadrons of the Duxford Big Wing made a timely entrance. The impact on German morale was devastating. Expecting the remnant of the British fighter force, they were confronted with a mass of some 150 RAF Spitfires and Hurricanes. As before, the German bombers were systematically stripped of their fighter escorts, with the formations broken up and attacked piecemeal. As well as these two major battles, the rest of the day saw several smaller attacks taking place. At 3 o'clock, 24 German aircraft targeted the Royal Navy base at Portland, with bombs causing heavy damage to houses and several small fires. The dockyard was hit, but the damage was not extensive. Later, at 5 o'clock, 40 ME-110s attacked Southampton, targeting the Supermarine factory at Woolston. Through the night, further raids were launched against London and other major towns. Meanwhile, the RAF had also been operational beyond the coast. Bomber Command launched several raids against Germany, and Coastal Command carried out numerous convoy protection and anti-submarine patrols. Both commands had launched heavy raids against the German invasion forces and shipping being gathered in French and Belgian ports. On a raid on the invasion barges being gathered at Antwerp, one of the Hamden bombers from No. 83 Squadron was hit and caught fire. The wireless operator, Sergeant John Hanna, extinguished the fire engulfing the aircraft and helped the pilot to land the aircraft safely home. For this act, he was awarded the Victoria Cross. Regarding losses, or indeed other statistics, the Battle of Britain as a whole is associated with conflicting figures. Both sides overclaimed at the time, which is understandable given the confused nature of aerial warfare, where several pilots could attack the same target. Contemporary reports recorded that on the 15th of September, over 180 enemy aircraft were destroyed, with 26 British aircraft damaged. Since the war, the figures have been reassessed, and the number of German losses reduced to around 60. Even so, this was the heaviest loss on a single day suffered by the Luftwaffe during the battle. 81 Luftwaffe personnel were recorded as killed or missing, with 13 RAF pilots killed. 57 civilians were also killed during the bombing raids in the London area. Keeping score had a huge impact on morale. Squadron leader Barclay recorded the 15th as,
"Our best day so far since the squadron was formed in May. I had one bullet hole in the starboard wing, but no damage done. British fighters shot down 185 enemy aircraft today. Boozy party this evening."
WAF Hazel Gregory remembers cheers in the operations room at RAF Uxbridge as the figures were announced at the end of the day. This sense of having had a good day contrasts with the experience of the Luftwaffe pilots. Horst Schlutz of Bombergeschwader 3 told the author Alfred Price,
"When we got back, we all agreed it had been a terrible day, but there was not much discussion. We were grateful to have survived."
Roderick Guscotti of Bombergeschwader 26 commented that,
"I regard 15th of September as the fiercest battle. Other battles did not make such a profound impression. Shaken by the number of fighters the RAF was able to put up on that day, and by the determination of the pilots."
The day certainly had an impact. Fighter Command had not been vanquished, and the Luftwaffe had failed to gain air superiority over the UK. Confidence amongst the German air crews had taken a severe blow too. Many now began to question the claims of their superiors about how weak the RAF had become, and began to doubt whether the battle could be won. 2 days later, Hitler decided to postpone, indefinitely, his plan to invade Britain. The 15th of September did not mark a clear victory or defeat in the battle, but from this date the course of the battle took a very different turn. Acknowledging that daylight raids could not succeed, over the next few weeks the Germans switched to night bombing and the Blitz began. As raids petered out at the end of October, due in part to bad weather, the battle had been won. Britain had withheld the invasion threat and stopped Germany in its tracks. For the first time since 1933, Nazi Germany had failed to impose its will on another nation through force of arms. As early as 1943, an annual commemoration of the Battle of Britain has taken place, with services of thanksgiving on the nearest Sunday to the 15th of September. Since then, parades, flypasts and services have taken place each year to mark this conflict. Official histories of the battle and biographies of the fighter pilots have been published, including Richard Hillary's The Last Enemy, which appeared as early as 1942. The artist Cuthbert Ord produced a stunning collection of portraits entitled Pilots of Fighter Command in 1943. Several memorials are in place around the country. In 1947, the Battle of Britain Memorial was unveiled in Westminster Abbey. For many, the focus has been on commemorating the few, a truly international group of pilots, just under half of whom did not survive the war. Veterans have been instrumental in establishing monuments, which include the evocative sculpture of a pilot watching the sky at Capel Le Fern near Folkestone in Kent, and the latest Battle of Britain monument, unveiled on the 18th of September 2005, on the Embankment in London, which depicts all of those involved with the battle. In terms of this special 70th anniversary year, events have been taking place around the country, and many of these have been accompanied by a flypast of the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, a visual, tangible reminder of those who paid the ultimate sacrifice during the battle, but also the Second World War.
That was a podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum's Battle of Britain series. If you would like to learn more about the history of the Battle of Britain, why not visit the museum's Battle of Britain Hall in London, which houses the world's most comprehensive collection of aircraft that fought in the battle. The hall is open daily from 12 noon to 6 p.m.